Just as a quick recap of Ecclesiastes, so a couple things we've observed about Solomon. The first is that he is the wisest man of all time. So he wasn't just wise, he wasn't just smart. We see in Kings that when God is blessing him with wisdom, he says he will be wiser than anyone who came before him and anyone who will follow after him. So Solomon is wise. We see some things that Solomon has identified as meaningless as well, as we've looked at these first two chapters. He says that good times are meaningless. He says that great accomplishments are meaningless. He says that stacks of cash, that being wealthy, that having all the wealth he could desire at the tip of his fingers, it's meaningless. It's been a dark couple of weeks here if you've been gone. Because a lot of what Solomon has been looking at are these things in life that are meaningless. But he doesn't say that he despises these things in the kind of way that you might imagine. He actually talks about them as pleasures. He talks about them as things that brought delight to his heart. He talks about them as things that he enjoyed being a participant in. And so what we see with Solomon is that he experimented with lots of things that bring us pleasure, that brought him pleasure, that brought him this sense of temporary happiness as he pursued this life of excess, as he pursued great accomplishments through work, as he accumulated great amounts of wealth, greater amounts of wealth than he had when he became king. We see this picture of someone who has it all and who was happy in having it all, but he wasn't on this pursuit of happiness. He wasn't on this pursuit for pleasure or for the desires of his heart. He was on a pursuit for meaning. And all of those things, as he experiments with them and evaluates them, he comes to the conclusion that ultimately they don't matter. They don't last. He's still looking for something of meaning. And lots of you know that I'm a big music fan, and even if you are a marginal fan of music, you know the band U2. Even with the high level of subjectivity that comes with evaluating any kind of art or music or things of that nature, it's not really disputed that U2 has been one of the most successful, one of the best bands of all time. I mean, they've had a career that has spanned over the course of multiple decades. They have been a band that has avoided some of the pitfalls that often comes with success, as far as pride or ego that could split a band apart. They have continued to make new kinds of music, and their style has evolved and changed over the course of decades in their career. They've done a lot of good work for the world around them. In most any ways that you could evaluate a band, you would say that they have experienced an incredible level of success. And maybe in the most important evaluation of that for lots of folks is that they've had number one after number one after number one single album hit. There's a lot there. And yet, even after decades of having a very successful career, there is still one song that people come back to and think about when they think of the band U2. The song I Still Haven't Found What I'm Looking For, which was released off the 1987 album Joshua Tree, is one that has circled the globe for decades as U2 has been going on tour, mostly nonstop over the course of the last 30-plus years. And so this song, it's not only like one of the most popular U2 songs. Like if you were going to think of a top five list, it would almost always be on there. If you were going to come up with a top three list, I would say it would almost always be on there. But it's not just kind of that people think this is one of U2's best songs. It's that objectively, this is one of the most popular songs that has ever been written. When Rolling Stone, a few years ago, they came out with a list of the 500 greatest songs of all time. And I don't think they were, accounting for classical music on that list. This was pop music, rock music, things like that. They listed it as number three. Not just the number three song of U2, the number three song of all time. And there's a reason why this song, for over three decades, has been meaningful to people of different cultures all around the world, people in different of different generations and different generational values that come with that, people that live in wildly different life circumstances. This song has been able to impact them because when Bono and when the band wrote the song, they were able to tap into something that was deep and meaningful about the human experience, something that kind of spans across all those generational or wealth kind of issues, something that spans across cultural values. And it was this same thing that Solomon is searching for in Ecclesiastes. It's this pursuit of something that is meaningful. And if you look at the actual breakdown of the song, I mean, Bono kind of writes a lot of the things that we read in Ecclesiastes. He writes about how he experiments with different things under the sun in this life. And at the end, his conclusion, he doesn't say meaningless, meaningless, or vanity, vanity, but he keeps coming back to this line, I still haven't found what I'm looking for. And for a lot of us, that notion, that kind of deeply resonates within us and within our hearts. And so we're going to pick up on Solomon's pursuit of meaning in Ecclesiastes chapter 2. And we're going to start reading in verse 12. So he says this, it says, then I turned my thoughts to consider wisdom and also madness and folly. This is significant. We know that Solomon has wisdom, but he is working through this as part of his test, kind of his experiment, his kind of test case to see, is wisdom going to be the thing that provides meaning for my existence? Is wisdom going to be the thing that gives me meaning in life? And it goes on to say, what more can the king's successor do than what has already been done? I saw that wisdom is better than folly, just as light is better than darkness. So this seems to be a sign of progress for Solomon. It starts to sound like the book's taking kind of a spin towards something that's a little bit more hopeful. He's saying, look, I've kind of stepped back. I've evaluated life. I've evaluated what it means to live with a sense of wisdom and what it means to live with folly. And he doesn't say meaningless, meaningless right away. He says, look, it is better to be a person that lives with a sense of wisdom than to be a person who lives in folly. It's better to be a person who considers the consequences of their actions, who looks with a long-term vision and perspective of life. It's better to be a person who's concerned about living in a way that is good than it is to be a person who lives in the moment. Kind of that idea of living in folly, that idea of experiencing folly, it could mean on one hand just living in immaturity. It could mean kind of this sense of not being someone who thinks through their next step, but it also kind of gives this sense when we live in folly that we sort of live haphazardly in the moment in whatever we're experiencing, and we just make a decision without any concern or regard or thought towards the future. And so Solomon says, hey, it's better to be a person who thinks through life than a person who doesn't, who just reacts, who just responds in the moment or doesn't have a sense of forethought. And then he speaks even more passionately about this as he goes on in verse 14 when he says, the wise have eyes in their heads while the fool walks in darkness. He sets up this imagery for us to imagine that the difference between being wise and being foolish is like stumbling around in a room in the dark without kind of a sense of where you're going with the lights off, or being a person who has the lights on, a person who has eyes that can see in their head, a person who can look in the direction they're going and navigate circumstances with meaning. So wisdom is better than folly. It seems encouraging. And then Solomon drops this bomb. He says, but I came to realize that the same fate overtakes them both. And in that, Solomon identifies the human condition. The problem with life is death. He realizes that even though it's better to be a person who lives with wisdom, a person who lives with maturity, with forethought, a person who's seeking to do the right things and take the right steps in life, even though it's better to live with that than it is to live in the moment and to respond and to react and to do whatever fulfills our cravings or desires in a time, that at the end of the day, a person who lives with an incredible sense of wisdom and a person who lives in the moment, they both have the same fate in that they both end their life in death. It's a dark, depressing thought, but it's true. And we all know people who have demonstrated this. We can all think of people who lived with a great sense of wisdom, just think in one area of life. If we would just think of living with wisdom in regards to our health, we can think of people who are very conscientious and very wise about the things that they ate, about getting enough exercise, about getting enough rest, about taking care of their bodies, about kind of looking and living, looking to the future and living with a sense of health, and yet still they can fall prey to some kind of a horrible disease or cancer or be in a car accident and their life can be cut short. And then on the other hand, we know people that live in folly, people that don't take care of themselves, people that have a poor diet, people that don't care about rest or exercise or things like that, people that indulge in all kinds of things that we know aren't wise and aren't healthy, but they give us temporary pleasure in a moment, and they still live a very long and full life. Solomon says it's better to live with wisdom than with folly, but in the end, we all meet the same kind of fate. And then he goes on to say this, starting in verse 15. He says, "Then I said to myself, the fate of the fool will overtake me also. What then do I gain by being wise? I said to myself, like a broken record, this too is meaningless. For the wise, like the fool, will not be long remembered. The days have already come when both have been forgotten. Like the fool, the wise too must die." So as he's processing all this, he goes back to that notion of legacy that he mentioned earlier on in the book. And he says, look, you know, earlier on he said it kind of doesn't matter what you do in this life. You'll die and you'll be buried and you won't be remembered very long. And so he comes back to this and he says the same is true with wisdom. It doesn't matter if you live wisely or if you live in folly. You'll die, you'll be buried, and your legacy will not live very long. It might last a few generations. It might be carried on in pictures or files or dates, but the remembrance of our lives is not very long. And with that kind of realization, things go from bad to worse. Solomon says in 17, "So I hated life, because the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me. All of it is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. I hated all the things I had toiled for under the sun, because I must leave them to the one who comes after me. And who knows whether that person will be wise or foolish. Yet they will have control over all the fruit of my toil, into which I have poured my effort and skill under the sun. This too is meaningless." Not only does it not matter that he, as the wisest man on the planet, will die like the most foolish man on the planet, but he says the fact that he's going to die, it brought upon this very clear disdain and hopelessness in life. It kind of went from meaningless to hopeless in the narrative. He could do great things. He could be wise. He could, you know, invest properly for his children. He could set them up with all the different political allegiances that he worked on building as a king. He could accomplish these incredible building projects. And we know that this isn't, you know, we're reading two chapters of a book. It would take us like 4 or 5 minutes if we just started in chapter 1, verse 1 and kept reading through. But he's talking about a life that spans over the course of years. We don't know how long the excess lasted, but we know that the building projects between the temple and his house took him 20 years to accomplish this feat. So he's not just saying, I like thought about this for 10 minutes and life is pretty stupid. He's saying like, I live this. I tried. I pursued it. I'm thinking about it. And I just am not finding the meaning. And he starts to think about the end of his life and says, I can do all these great things. I can leave them to my heirs and my children. and they could mess it all up, and I won't have any kind of control over that. It might be a little bit different for us today, but we still can pay for braces for our kids, and they can eat candy when we're not watching and mess up their teeth. You know, we can still pay for their college, and it can be a lot more like a party than a preparation kind of period. We still can, for our kids, we can set them up with a really nice kind of inheritance in life, and they could sell it all off and buy stock in Bitcoin. And I'm not looking to offend the cryptocurrency fans among us, but just to say that it's volatile. It's not wise to put it all in there. So we can live life like this. You know, we can set people up as best as we're able with as much as we're able to do. We can try this, and there's no, the promises are that someday at the end we'll pass away and then we'll lose any kind of control that we had in setting things up in the way that we wanted to. It's a hard, hard kind of realization that he works through. But let's read in verse 20. As he says, so my heart began to despair over all my toilsome labor under the sun. For a person may labor with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, and then they must leave all they own to another who has not toiled for it. This too is meaningless and a great misfortune. What do people get for all the toil and anxious striving with which they labor under the sun? All their days their work is grief and pain. Even at night, their minds do not rest. This too is meaningless. He says that our work is meaningless. The things we accumulate in life are meaningless. The way that we are filled with anxiety and despair in life. So even kind of what he seems to be describing, this anxiety over looking for meaning, he says, meaningless. At the end of this life of anxiety, I'll still die. This is dark and cynical. His view of leaving a legacy to the people who are going to follow after him is dark, and it's cynical. And this is not the way that we often think of in leaving legacies. And there was just a moment. So 2 weeks ago, we drove out to Pittsburgh for a funeral. A friend of ours, their mother had passed away, and so we went out, and we were there for the service, And our friend, she was sharing this story about her mom, and she was saying that even as an adult, when she was a kid, her mom was an adult, and she decided she was going to go back to school, and so she was kind of the story of a mom who was working full time, who was going to school in the evenings, and our friend was sharing this story. She said, even in the midst of that kind of crazy schedule, my mom was always available to us. My mom always made time for us. My mom always made our lives a priority to her. And she talked about that legacy for her as a mom who was working and was going back to school, that her mom had set that legacy in her mind and that she was following that. That's what we think of as legacy. In the, you know, it's kind of lost a little bit of the heat, but in the red hot Broadway musical Hamilton that was just kind of blowing up, legacy was one of the big things that he was concerned about. And he gave this, the songwriter, it gives this cool kind of imagery of legacy at one point as Alexander Hamilton is singing. He describes that legacy's like a garden, and that he was getting to plant the garden and that other people who came after him would be able to reap the harvest from that. That's what we think about when we think about our legacy. And Solomon writes about that as well in the book of Proverbs in a very different light. In chapter 13, verse 22 in Proverbs, he says, a good person leaves an inheritance for their children's children, but a sinner's wealth is stored up for the righteous. In Proverbs 22:6, he says, start children off on the way they should go, and even when they are old, they will not turn from it. So Solomon wasn't a guy who was like anti-legacy and leaving things behind, but he's looking at the way he's living for all of this stuff and not finding meaning. And it's in this place of despair as he writes negatively about the idea of leaving things to the people that will follow after him. And yet, he's accurate. When we pass on, our inheritance and what we leave behind us on this earth, it passes into the hands of people who will follow after us, and there's no promise of how they will respond with that. And so it seems, as Solomon goes through this book, he describes life. And he says, look, the partying life or the chaste life, a life where you are stoic or a life where you're very virtuous or a life where you party, they both meet in that common place of death. A life where you've toiled and accomplished incredible things or a life where you've just kind of coasted through and not been very concerned, they both meet and find this commonality in death at the end of our lives. A life where you've accumulated great wealth or haven't accumulated wealth, they meet. A life where you've lived with wisdom or you lived with folly, they meet. And then, after he says this is meaningless, at this point in chapter 2 in Ecclesiastes, there's really this turning point in the story. There's kind of a shift that takes place. And beginning in verse 24, Solomon says this, a person can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in their own toil. This too, I see, is from the hand of God. And this is really the first time where he starts talking about the Creator in his pursuit of meaning. And he says, for without him, who can eat or find enjoyment? To the person who pleases him, God gives wisdom, knowledge, and happiness. But to the sinner, he gives the task of gathering and storing up wealth to hand it over to the one who pleases God. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. But this is a difference. So that this too is meaningless at the end there, that's referring to the person who, the sinner who works and stores up wealth and then hands it over to the one who pleases God. So in this section, in these verses, we see three shifts in the way that Solomon has been thinking about life. And the first is this, that Solomon begins to acknowledge God in the pursuit of meaning. It seems obvious that Solomon believed in God. He spent 7 years building a temple to God. He prayed to God to ask for wisdom, and it was granted to him. There are all of these things, you know, he was the leader of God's people. There's little doubt that Solomon didn't believe in God before this point, but he hasn't mentioned him at all in this pursuit of meaning. And now, Solomon begins to acknowledge that it's God who gives us, he doesn't say meaning yet, but that without God, how could a person ever find enjoyment in life? He's the one who gives wisdom, knowledge, and happiness. He begins to kind of make this shift to acknowledging God. The second is this, that Solomon recognizes that his wisdom, that wisdom in general, it is from God. And again, this shouldn't be very surprising to us, because if you read through 1 Kings, which we did, Solomon asked God for wisdom. God responds and grants him with wisdom. Solomon knew that, but when you read earlier in Ecclesiastes, in chapter 1, verse 16, Solomon says, I said to myself, look, I have increased in wisdom more than anyone who has ever ruled over Jerusalem before me. I have experienced much of wisdom and knowledge. It's not a line that makes you think Solomon's really crediting God with the wisdom that he has. He's saying, I worked for this. I gained it. I have wisdom. I have knowledge. I'm wiser than anyone who has preceded me that ruled over God's people. But then there's this shift as he's working through life where he recognizes the wisdom he possesses has been given to him from God. And third, and maybe most importantly, Solomon moves, after two chapters, Solomon moves beyond nihilism. Solomon moves beyond this notion that everything around us is meaningless. And he recognizes, even if at this point, he's still not saying he's experienced that meaning in life. He's still not saying, I figured it out and I'm happy and everything is better now. I found that sense. But he's recognizing that there is meaning in life and that meaning comes from God. There's a theologian named Mark Eaton who writes commentaries, and he wrote about the book of Ecclesiastes, and he says this, that right up until chapter 2, verse 24, he says, the preacher's review of creation, history, life, and death has ended in a picture of physical and mental anguish. He's saying that up until this point, everything that Solomon says has been negative and has been hard to listen to. But we see this sense as Solomon begins to turn to God that there's hope that things could be different. And there are two things that I want us to think about that Solomon reveals for us just in these last few verses that apply to our lives. The first is this, that life is intended to be enjoyed. We have not gotten that sense thus far in the book of Ecclesiastes. It has been a lot of doom and gloom and meaningless and vanity kind of discussion. But in this piece, Solomon reveals that life is intended to be enjoyed. And of course, this doesn't mean there isn't hardship in life. He's been very clear about outlining what that hardship was. And even if he wasn't clear, many of us could look at life and point out plenty of the circumstances we've experienced that have brought upon hardship in our lives, that have created hardship in our lives. Maybe it's things we've done or things other people have done that have impacted us. Hardship in life is a reality. But Solomon makes it clear that even if he is not experiencing enjoyment in life at this point, that God provides people with a sense of enjoyment and pleasure and happiness in their life and in their work. We see this communicated in the New Testament as well. In 1 Timothy chapter 4, verses 4 and 5, we read, "For everything God created is good, and nothing is to be rejected if it is received with thanksgiving, because it is consecrated by the word of God and prayer." He says, for everything created is good. That includes us. That was the design for us. That was the design for the created order that we find ourselves in, the world that we find ourselves in. The intent of the world was that it would be good, that it would be a place of happiness and pleasure and meaning. And Solomon begins to recognize that. That's what life was intended to be like, even if it isn't like that in his experience. And the second piece is this, and this is a little bit of a harder truth. I'll own that. That God blesses those who please them. And when I say that's a harder truth, it's just important to clarify a couple of things. And so first, I want to say this, that when we say God blesses those who please him, what we don't mean is that, and many of you understand this, we don't mean there's anything we could do that would bring about the blessing of God in our lives. That we can't work hard enough and be good enough and do enough that then we can kind of force the hand of God into blessing us because he blesses those who please him in that kind of a sense. There's nothing that we can do to earn righteousness or blessing from God. It also, I want to be clear in saying this, that this isn't like a health and wealth kind of gospel. It isn't that when we're people who please God that we get, you know, wealthy and happy and clappy and things like that. I'm not making that kind of a statement here, that God blesses those who please him in that kind of a sense. And I also want to be clear and say this, that if you're here this morning and you haven't placed faith in Christ yet, what I'm about to say might sound a little bit arrogant, and I'm going to ask you to listen with an open mind before you just tune me out right away. When we say that God blesses those who please him, we look to verse 26, and it says that sinners and people who do not please God do not experience the kind of blessing that he provides for those who please him. In chapter 2, as it's ending, it says that God gives wisdom, he gives knowledge, he gives happiness to those who please him. He blesses the lives of people who please him. But it says that there are sinners and there are people who not only will not experience that kind of blessing, but will also not receive that kind of inheritance that comes for the people who please God. And it's clear that Solomon isn't advocating for some kind of like dominion and rule over people when he says that the people who don't please God, they work and they toil and their wealth and their inheritance is passed on to those who please him. He's not saying that the people should take from other people who don't please God. He's not saying that that people should reign over them in that kind of a sense. Solomon is describing, it's almost a prophetic word, he's describing a future reality of what it means to be people of faith. We see it again, we already read this once, but in Proverbs 13, verse 22, when it says, "A good person leaves an inheritance for their children's children, but a sinner's wealth is stored up for the righteous." That second end of that, a sinner's wealth is stored up for the righteous. We see this in the teachings of the New Testament as well. When Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount in the Beatitudes, when he says, "Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. There's an inference there that when some people are inheriting the earth, that other people are not inheriting the earth. We see this in the writings of Paul in 2 Corinthians chapter 6. He's describing the hardship of some of the difficult elements of the Christian life. And he says that as he's describing Christians, he says that we're like people who, while we are having nothing and yet possessing everything. It's this description of kind of a future reality that the people of God will inherit the earth. And so when Solomon says, hey, for the people who are sinners, who spend their lives toiling and working, and other people will benefit that, he's not talking about like a one-to-one, like one sinner passes over their goods to a person who's righteous in the eyes of God. He's talking about this future reality that there are people who are righteous and who are in relationship with God, and that they will be people who inherit the earth, and that there are people who are not in that position. The realization after two chapters, kind of that Solomon arrives at, and we're not done with this book yet, but the realization he arrives at after two chapters is kind of that there are two ways to live. One is the pattern he's been describing. There's this vicious pattern of the world that we live in, where we are just working and trying to find meaning in things of this life that will never satisfy us. We'll continue to be kind of like U2's 30-year tour playing I Still Haven't Found What I'm Looking For, where we can just try and experiment with all kinds of things, but it becomes this vicious reality where we just keep looking and looking and looking and not finding. Or we can be people who live a life of faith and who look to God to be the one who provides us with wisdom and knowledge and happiness. A life where we're blessed in the goodness of the creation because we've experienced the Creator, because we're following the Creator. We have these two kind of choices that Solomon lays out for us. And this morning, as we close our time in worship, we're going to close with communion together. And in this act of communion, this is an act of remembrance and an act of proclamation, where we remember that it is Christ and the life that we have in Him that places us in a position where we don't experience that vicious pattern of meaninglessness that Solomon talks about, but where we have the opportunity to be people who experience that blessing of God. To be people who experience that inheritance of God. And so this morning, as we pass the plates, and as you take time to confess and to reflect and to remember the sacrifice of Christ, I would also ask you to think about this, to meditate and to think on the reality that God not only forgives you of your sins, but that He has taken us off of this vicious pattern and pursuit of meaning, because He has provided us with lasting meaning and a future inheritance of a blessing in His presence with Him.